The Sportscast, July 30th, 2021. If you haven't yet, please subscribe in all our channels, YouTube, Twitch.tv, Twitter, and Apple Podcasts. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. And, of course, visit our website, thesportscast.net, or you can also get our app for iOS in the iOS App Store. Be highly appreciated if you leave a rating and a review as well there as well. So today we have a special guest. Not so much a sports news show today, but we're going to reminisce. We have interviewed authors in the past, sports authors, and today we have something special today. Zach Rebikoff, author of The Unmasked Umpire. Of course, umpire is, MLB, old-time bowl. America's great history with that. And Zach, join us all the way from South Florida. Welcome to the Sportscast.
Thank you.
So Zach, your book, Unmasking the Brotherhood, The Unmasked Umpire, I've read a few excerpts of the book, and it goes back, you know, when you first started and how your folks first immigrated. So tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, first of all, Unmasking the Brotherhood is sort of a phrase that I use, but the actual name of the book is Unmasked, The Honorable and Dishonorable Truths of a Professional Baseball Umpire. And I think I was mostly honorable on the field, but perhaps dishonorable off the field in later life. And we can talk about that later, but generally speaking, I was most honorable on the field. There was one player that I have to say I was dishonorable with. And if I can think back, it was probably like 1976. His name was Wayne Pinkerton. And he was a shortstop for Asheville Tourists, who were, I believe, the Texas Rangers organization in Class A in the Western Carolina League. And one day I was on the bases. I had a play at second. He was tagging someone or stepping on, I don't know, something like that. Anyway, I called it safe. And when the players got back in position, the pitcher was going to pitch, I heard him whisper behind my back, "You'll die in this league." I was livid. I turned around, I yelled at him, I pointed at him, and I said, and it was the only time I ever did this because I was a young umpire. I made his life miserable at home plate. There were only four teams in the league, which meant only four umpires, which meant only two games per night. So me being behind the plate was 50-50. So whenever he came to bat, all the pitch had to do was let it go. It was a strike. So after about a month or two of this, he spoke to my partner, Nick Sharkey, and he said, "Listen, please, I need you to ask Zach to please stop it. I'm begging you. I won't you do that anymore. I won't say anything anymore. Please, I'm begging you." This guy was losing weight. His batting average was like 160. I mean, I just made life miserable then. But I would never do that again. I mean, it was a mistake on my part to do that.
So, Zach, tell us a little bit about how you got into baseball. Was your folks, your family? Tell us a little bit about that that introduction to the great sport.
Well, my dad was a big baseball fan, you know, and I used to watch the games with him and became a baseball player. You know, I felt like I was a great athlete. I played in the Bronx. I grew up in the Bronx, played stickball in the Bronx, hit three sewers in the Bronx, if you know what that means. And I guess around the age of around 21, I was just driving a taxi in Yonkers, and I had this friend of mine. And we were watching TV one day, and there used to be these commercials that came on TV, and they would say, you know, "Truck Driver Training Institute, earn $300 a week, you know, send in something." He goes, "You know, that's for you." And And we're watching more TV. Another commercial comes on and says, computer training, earn 300 a week, call it. That's for you. One day we're watching an NBA game. He goes, you know what? This job is for you. I go, what? I have thanks. He goes, no, it's some part of your job. I go, you know what? I like that. So I called the commissioner's office, found out that there was umpire school, registered for umpire school, and went to umpire school in 1975.
Incredible.
74 was actually 74 was my first year. I went back again in 75 and I got a job. Yeah.
Incredible. So tell us your experience in umpire school. No one really talks about it. Never. I have actually never heard, many interviews with referees or umpires. But tell us your experience in that school.
Well, several experiences. First of all, it was the first time I've ever really left New York. I went down to umpire school, drove down there, and all the guys at umpire school, most of the guys were from the South or from the West. A lot of the Southerners, Latinx, had never been around before, and I just really thought that they were weird guys, drinking, back slapping. I wasn't interested in that. I never liked alcohol. I still don't really drink alcohol, so I wasn't one of those boys. And my idea was to work very hard, learn how to do this, and get a job. So I had one friend in the whole place named Dave Zimdars from Madison, Wisconsin. We hung around. I didn't hang around with any of those guys. And I sized up about 3 or 4 days. I sized up the competition. It was about 100 guys there. I sized it up. I go, you know what? I think I'm in the top 25% for this. I can do this. About a week or two in, I was sleeping. And I sleep nude. I'm in this in the bunks. They had like barracks for bunks. All of a sudden, like a group of the umpires, students come in, grab me, start carrying me over their head like I'm Lou Costello in a movie, like taking me to the stake, burning me at the stake. They're carrying me over their heads. I'm naked. They're laughing. They're yelling. They're going, bring him here. Bring him here. Finally, they end up taking me to the pool and throw me in the pool. And I'm going, what the? I was in shock. I didn't do anything to those guys. I never spoke to them. I didn't even know they knew I was alive. The most interesting thing about it, I was when I buoyed up from the water, I looked at that group and I saw one of the guys was one of the instructors there, Jim McKeon. He's dead. He was a major league umpire from Canada, and he was the ringleader of this. And I'm thinking, is that possible? I'm a paying student at the school, and he's the ringleader. And these guys, carrying me, throwing me in the pool. Well, went back to the barracks, no one said a word. Next day, I don't remember exactly what happened, but I remember it never came up again. Never came up, finished the school, came in, I don't know, maybe 15 or 16. I didn't get a job. But I went back home to New York. I worked every baseball game, every softball I could find. And went back to the school next year, and I came in the top three in every instructor's list. And that's when I started, Midwest.
Incredible, incredible moment there with the hazing and
Oh,
going.
there's one other thing that was interesting at the school, though. Now that I think of it. So we would practice in the afternoon. And what they would do is the instructors would take some of the umpires, nine of them, put them in the field. And then take two umpires, put one behind the plate and one on the bases, and then make situations, man on first, one on first and second, first and third, grounder, fly ball, and then have us, call the plays, go to the positions that you needed to do. So John McSherry was the lead instructor and the instructor on the field that day, and I was on the bases. He goes, all right, first and second, one out. And they hit. And one of the other instructors hits a fungo, a grounder to third. They throw to second. I call him out. First, I call him out. And McSherry yells, "Face the ball! Run it again." I was facing the ball. How do you think I saw them? All right, they run it again. Same thing. Ground the third, throw to the second, out, throw to the first, out, get them both right again. Louder this time. Face the ball. Run it again. How does he think I'm standing if I'm not facing the line? Runs it again. Exact same thing. He comes walking over me after the third time. He takes his big hands and actually physically turns me and faces my body towards each position of the ball. In other words, he wanted me to turn as the ball came off the bat towards the third baseman. When he threw it to second, follow the ball, turning my body, and then follow the ball and turn my body towards first. They do it again. I do it. He goes, "Give this guy a hand. This man finally understands what the meaning of face the ball is." And that, I never forgot that. And it's really the key, one of the keys to umpiring is to face the ball. You know, as a player, you go towards the ball, you follow the ball. As an umpire, you face it and back away from it, but you keep your eye on it every single second because the ball takes you to the play. If there's no ball, there's not going to be a play there. But if the ball is going somewhere, there is going to be a play there. So that's why I always face the ball or follow the ball.
Unbelievable. What a story. Tell us about the betrayals from my partners in both the U.S. and the DR, Dominican Republic.
Well, okay. It's not uncommon for this to happen. I never participated in backstabbing or betraying anyone. And I swear on everything. I'm willing to take a lie detector at any time for anyone, any part of my book that may seem true or untrue. But in the Dominican Republic, I think it was 1979, six umpires are recruited every year to Dominican, Venezuela, Colombia, and Puerto Rico. So I was in the Dominican Republic. Bob Davidson was there. Pete Caleri was there. Steve Ripley was there. Sonny Fouts and another guy named Galen. And it seemed that Steve Ripley, did not like me. I don't know exactly why. But again, I wasn't a beer drinker. I wasn't a back slapper. And he liked that shit. And I didn't. I didn't even like being around that. And, you know, they start drinking and it's like getting loud and berating people, making fun of them, making fun of the Dominican umpires, making fun of everything. So I was just on my own. And in fact, I met a woman there who Ripley thought he would be playing around with, and she liked me. We ended up she became a love of my life, actually. But it's a sort of a sidebar. But Ripley didn't like me. Well, one night we had a game in San Pedro de Macorís. I had to play. Ripley was on the bases, Caleri was on the bases, and another umpire, Eddie Duran, was on the bases. And I think it was in the sixth or seventh inning, the pitcher, his name, I think it was Silverio, something like that. Anyway, guy was as old as the hills, but he was a big, big fan favorite. And he, every time I called the ball, he would be making like, like demonstrative motions, which would get the crowd going. Well, he did it so much that the crowd started throwing stuff on the field. I halted the game, go to the dugout, Australia dugout, the home team, asked for the general manager to come down. Nobody comes. Speak to the manager again. I need the general manager to come down. They need to make an announcement. Nobody comes. Caleri and Ripley, instead of helping me, talking to me, working it out, kept on to the side, their hands, arms folded like this, waiting to see how I would do, not helping me, not talking to me, not working as a crew. Well, after about 10 minutes, no help from the stadium police, no help from the general manager, no help from them, I head. I'm going to forfeit this game to the manager if nobody comes to help. But I wait another 5 minutes, I forfeited the game. And I'll never forget that those guys on the way home, what did you do that for? Why did you do that? Why did you do that? Why didn't you help me? You're an asshole. That's why. You wanted me to have trouble, and now I have it. So that's one particular circumstance where you're betraying your partners, not being professional, taking whatever your issues are off the field onto the field. That should never happen. And the United States, although I don't consider this a real betrayal, I did consider it a lack of support. I was working in the International League with Scott Grinder and John Hirschbeck. I believe it was 1982. Yes, 1982. And there was a game in Columbus. In Columbus, Ohio, it was the Yankees farm team, Triple A team. And the president of the league also had his office there. And they had a beautiful stadium, the best stadium. And at that time, it was probably the best minor league stadium in all the country in Columbus. Beautiful. AstroTurf, big scoreboard. I mean, they packed in 15,000 fans a night. It was a really, really nice place, nice environment to work in. Well, anyway, I called Bobby Brown. We used to call him up and down Bobby Brown. He used to go up to the Yankees and down, up to the Yankees and down. Center field. I called him out, play it first. And he went back to the dugout, you know, jawing at me, blah, blah, blah. I throw him out of the game, comes out of the game, comes out yelling and screaming, takes first base, steals it. I mean, it was a whole, like, shit house. So that's the end of that. The next day we go to Toledo. And I ended up throwing, it was 2 days later, I had third base. I had to throw another guy out of the game because of a check swing. So now two ejections within 3 days. And sure enough, we're going back to Columbus. And the president of the league asks us to stop by his office, which he always did anyway.
Wow.
We go to the office, and it doesn't take 2 minutes. The president's going, why did you throw out Bobby Brown? You didn't know it was him. I go, I didn't know it was him. He goes, no, you didn't. And I'm thinking, what? Here's the president of the league telling me I shouldn't have thrown out the best player on their team because that's his team. He sat in the press box. He sat in the luxury box with the Columbus owners, George Sisler. That was his favorite team. I basically didn't do something. I did something that he didn't appreciate. And instead of not even mentioning it, he brings it up to me and he goes, why'd you throw out the guy the other night? And now, but here's the point. Scott Grinder is sitting on one side of the room, John Hirschbeck sitting on the other. They sat on their hands, didn't open their mouths. What they should have done was said, Mr. Cooper, Zach was right. If that was us, we would have done the same thing. But they didn't. They sat there, and I never forgave them for that. I forgot about it, but I never truly forgave them for not speaking up and supporting me, because that could have very easily have happened to them. We've all had rejections that went sideways on us. They should have said something, and I didn't like that.
There was a lot of betrayal and like these circles, I guess, back then. Why was that? Was that just part of the culture at the time, or?
I don't know if there was a lot of betrayals, but there were betrayals. I mean, remember, your partner and you are both working to get up the ladder.
Very competitive.
You're supposed to be partners. You're supposed to be friends. But on the other hand, you're thinking, you know what? How am I going to differentiate myself from this guy so that the supervisors think I'm better than him? And I move up. Maybe we both move up, but I got to do something to differentiate myself, make myself different than him. I can't be look like him, act like him, ump like him. I got to be different. I got to be myself. I got to distinguish myself. And so I never did any of that stuff. And I'm not sure that I would interpret what Grinder and Hirschbeck didn't do that day as a betrayal, but I think that they just failed when it came, when it comes to loyalty. That's what I think happened.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you think that's happening today still in like umpire school? Do you think it's or it's completely different?
Got it. Yeah. You know, again, you got 100 guys in umpire school. You know, trying to differentiate yourself there, it may be even harder because, you know, a lot of people that go there, even if they've umpired before, they may have been doing it incorrectly. They may have had, you know, been doing it too quickly. Whatever their old habits were or are, they got to relearn it. And they see the competition. They know only perhaps a handful or 10 guys are going to make it through and get jobs. So maybe subconsciously they do it, or inherently they do it, or purposely. I would say most of the time they don't, but occasionally you'll probably find somebody trying to make their way at someone else's disposal.
Yeah. Tell us your relationship with the players and the coaches as an umpire.
You learn early on that they're not your friends. You know, the game starts, you're umpiring first base, first baseman is like, you know, how's the wife and the kids and this and that. And so what happens is a play at first base, and all of a sudden it's a shithouse, and this guy is up your ass. And he's calling you everything in the book. And wait a minute, 2 minutes ago, you asked me about the wife and kids. What happened? So, you know, there's no loyalty when it comes to them. And certainly, you know, you got to be careful about fraternizing with the players. I don't necessarily mean at the ballpark. But, I mean, you know, remember, you're in the same town. You're in the same city. You may end up in the same restaurant. You don't want to be caught sitting at the bar with the players. Because if someone sees that, especially now with videos, here you are on video sitting with one of the players on the team, and the next day, instead of it being strike three, it's ball four. Of course, you were sitting at the bar with him. So that kind of stuff, I think most umpires know not to get involved with that. I mean, although, keep in mind, you got umpires in the majors who want autographs for their family, their friends, and they're sending the bat boy or the clubhouse guy, oh, go down and see, you know, this player down here, get these balls signed. Or maybe even ask them themselves. It's been going on for 100 years, umpires getting autographs.
Yeah, that's smart not to, you know, mesh in with the players and the coaches, because then, hey, like you were saying, people have cameras in their pockets or video and use their mobile device and take a picture.
Here's another instance where something happened. In 1994, I believe it was. I think it was 4 or 6, 19. I don't remember exactly. Player strike. And the umpires, the major league umpires, also held out in support of the players, which I thought was insane because players would never do that for them. But the umpires didn't report. So the American League and the National League had, you know, called around all kinds of umpires, and they asked me to come down to spring training and umpire some games. And I did. And I was at a game. I had to play. And there was two, three of us, me, a guy named Jeff Hendricks, who was a former minor league umpire himself, and another guy, I don't remember the other guy's name. I had to play in Fort Lauderdale Stadium, the Yankees versus somebody, I don't know. Well, before the game, I half dressed. I had my pants on, shoes on, undershirt. You know, I just walked out on the third base side, and you know, just to take in the stadium, look around, see what's doing, you know, smell the grass, watch the crowd come in. I had plenty of time to get dressed. And I see this guy that used to be on the Yankees. Was it an official or, a representative? Or some kind of guy I knew was on the Yankees from years ago. And I see him, hey, how you doing? He invites me to sit down at the end of the dugout. And we talking, you know, just going over some stuff. And I look down the far end of the dugout, and I see what looks to be George Steinbrenner signing autographs. So I say to my friend, I go, is that Steinbrenner? He goes, yeah. I go, who's the, and he's talking to a bunch of reporters and he's signing autographs. And I go, well, who's he signing those autographs for the reporters? He goes, no, he signs them. And you know, the team uses them as mementos. That's team signed balls. You want one? I go, yeah. Goes down there and brings me back one signed by Steinbrenner. Perfect. Right on the sweet spot. Cool. Go in the locker room. This guy Hendricks goes, where were you? Like he's in charge of me. Where were you? I go, I was outside. He goes, what's that ball you got? I go, Steinbrenner signed the ball. Friend of mine got it for me. Okay. And the game goes off. No hitches, no nothing, blah, blah, blah. Well, now it gets to the end of spring training, and these umpires, and the strike was still going on. So they had asked these umpires to continue on working with the replacement players until the players came back or the regular umpires came back. So I said, oh, you know, I was going to be one of those. So I go home waiting for the call, and I speak to a few of the umpires that were assigned down there. And they go, yeah, you know, I'm going to Seattle, I'm going to Baltimore, I'm going here, I'm opening up here, I'm opening up there. I'm going, what happened? I called Marty Springsteen, who was the supervisor of American League umpires. I go, Marty, I didn't get an assignment. He goes, yeah, we're not assigning you. How come? Well, you asked for autographs. I go, I didn't ask for any autographs. He goes, well, how'd you get assigned for his autograph? I go, someone gave it to me. I met a friend of mine. He goes, well, sorry, you're not doing it. You're not getting an assignment. Thank you very much. And here it is again, this fucking guy, Jeff Hendricks, no skin in the game, has a big mouth and tries to make trouble, starts a rumor. And that's what I'm talking about. No reason to do that, has to start a rumor. And now instead of me having my dream come true and umpiring in the majors for 5 or 6 games, I'm out because this guy starts to tell him I asked George Steinbrenner for an autograph.
That one incident could definitely cost you not do a game at least.
Well, I mean, I could have had 5 or 6 games with a nice paycheck, open the season. I think the strike was settled after about a week. Could have had probably 5 or 6 games. And instead, I was out because this guy started the rumor.
Unbelievable.
In the book.
Which that happened in 1994, right?
Yes.
Yes, I remember that strike because I remember when Michael Jordan kind of had to leave baseball because of that strike, and then he returned to basketball. So, quite interesting how things entail. Tell us about the drive from Jackson, Mississippi to El Paso, which is pretty far drive.
Me? What did I do? What did I do? Did I do something here?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Can you see me?
Yes, yes, I can see you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. So okay. In 1977, I was working in the Texas League, had the playoffs. And I was working with Larry Poncino, who became a major league umpire, and Tom Blackman. And it was the Jackson Mets, New York Mets organization in Jackson, Mississippi, against the El Paso Diablos, who were the Angels farm team. first two games were in Jackson. I had the second game behind plate. I was mad as hell because after this game, we had to drive 1,014 miles to El Paso while everyone on both teams, the president of the league, everybody was flying. The president of the league, Carl Swatsky, wanted to save money. So he makes us drive instead of putting us on a plane as well. I couldn't have been more unhappy, and I had been for a week knowing about this drive that's going to be coming up. Oh my God. You know, we used to do 300-400 miles a drive like it was nothing, but 1,000, and had to be there the next night to do a game. So after the game, I'm getting undressed, mad, sad, depressed. Sawatsky walks in the locker room and he's, oh, he's all giddy, you know, with playoff excitement. He goes over to Poncino and he's going over to Black and he's talking to them. Well, he sees me over there. And I'm not saying anything. He goes, what's the matter, Zach? You mad at something? I go, yeah, I am. Well, what's on your mind? He goes, I said, you look looking to save money, so you make us drive 1,000 miles and take our suitcases, our big case, and put them on a plane, but not us. You want to save money? Yeah, I think this is a problem. I'm pissed off. He goes, you want to go on a plane? You want to go home? I'll put you on a plane right now. You can go right home now. I go, I looked up, I stood up. He came right up to me like this. And I went, do it. He goes, runs out of the room. Poncino looks at me with his eyes are like wide. I'll never forget. He goes, are you nuts? You just got fired. Good. And I'm, but in the back of my mind, I'm going, oh my God, I am fired. Holy mackerel, I didn't know that was going to go like that, you know? Anyway, about 2 minutes later, Carl Sawatzky walks back in the locker room and he's holding a case of beer. He brings the beer and he puts it down on the table and he comes over and he goes, Zach, you know, I made a mistake. This was an error. I shouldn't have done that. Can you accept my apology? I brought a case of beer for you guys for the ride. Case of beer for the ride? What? I shake hands with him. I accept his apology. He goes out. I'm going, a case of beer for the ride? What? What kind of thing is that? We're supposed to drink beer and drive 16 hours? These guys, Poncino and Blackman, they're thrilled. I'm going, they get in the front seat. Blackman's driving, drinking. Poncino's sitting shotgun, drinking. And I'm in the back going, sweating. I'm going, what? And Blackman's like swerving a little bit. I go, listen, whoa, pull over, pull over. Get in the back. I took over. I drove the rest of the way myself. And then let those guys touch the wheel. They drank the whole case. We got to El Paso about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We get to the hotel. We call the stadium, make sure our equipment is there, because there were big cases and we couldn't have fit it in the car, all three of us. So they put them on the plane to go with the teams. No equipment. Didn't make the plane. No problem. Okay. We go to the stadium. No equipment. We're prepared to work in our clothes. And Larry's going to wear behind a plate of catches, equipment, you know, and masks. Sure enough, though, 20 minutes. 20 minutes before game time, the stuff arrived. We got dressed, did the game. El Paso won the third game. Season was over. And that was the end of that. But that ride, talk about a nightmare.
What year was that?
1977 or 1978, something like that.
Tell us your incident with Wade Boggs.
I think it was 79 or 80. I don't remember. 79 or 80. And Boggs was in AAA. He's playing for the Paw Sox, the Red Sox AAA team. And he's great. You know, he always goes 2 for 2. Always hits goes 2 for 4. So it's middle of the summer, I don't know, July something, you know, hot as hell out, day game. He hits the ground to the left side, close at first, I call him out. And he jumps up in the air, oh my God, I was safe, blah, 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 blah. He goes, you know what, Zach, this is going to cost me the batting title. I'm going, what? Middle of July, what kind of batting title? Anyway, believe it or not, it comes down to the last game of the season. I am in Toledo and the guy that's up in the batting title with him, I believe his name was Dave Engel. He's leading Boggs in the last day of the season by like 0.3 or 0.4 of a percentage point. He bats in our game. He gets a hit. Boggs goes 2 for 4 in another game, loses the batting title by 0.3 of a percentage point. So 10 years later, I see Boggs. I had press credentials or something at for the Yankees, and I go to see him. And I go, remember me? He goes, do I remember you? You cost me the batting title, remember? So he never forgot that.
Unbelievable. Well, Zach Rebikoff with his book. You get it on Amazon. Something that, you know, this is a good experience. The Unmasked Umpire. Zach, tell us, what is the best way to reach you? And what is the best way for people to get a copy of your book?
Well, first of all, they can go on, you can't buy it on my website, but you can click on the book on my website, which is theunmaskedumpire.com. You can click on the book and it'll take you to Amazon, or you can go directly to Amazon and type in Unmasked Zach Rebikoff, or Unmasked The Honorable or Dishonorable Truths of a Professional Baseball Umpire. You can buy the ebook version or the paperback version.
And you could definitely look in our show notes of this show, and you can click the link to purchase the book. And it's on Kindle and also on paperback, so make sure you get it. And Zach, tell us, what is the best way to reach you online, your social media handles and things like that?
Well, my email is zachreb, Z-A-C-H-R-E-B, 1951, at gmail.com. Z-A-C-H-R-E-B, 1951, at gmail.com. And again, all through my website, through the contact page on my website.
And tell us about your other book.
Oh, well, I also authored a novel named 1,000 Miles Under Gunpoint. And it's a novel that about a Russian mob boss that carjacks a Yonkers taxi driver, which I was at one point, and for a murder spree. And it's about 90,000 words, about 350 pages. And it's got a lot of twists and turns. I don't think anybody will ever guess the end, even up until the very last sentence. There's something that no one would think of. So hopefully suspense lovers will take a look at that as well.
Which we were talking about before the show, that looks like you found another hidden talent and is writing books.
Well, I mean, my first book that I published was in 1982. And I wrote that, I decided to write a book. I bumped into an agent in a bar who said, you know, what's in the case? And I told him I have some pictures in there, I'm writing a book. He looked at it. 4 days later, he had got me an advance of $10,000 from Avon Books. Miracle. It's just a miracle, because it just doesn't happen. It's very hard to get an advance these days. And back then, 10 grand was, I don't know, a lot of money. So and I was very fortunate. So 2 months later, I had a finished book, and it was published by Avon.
There you have it. Zach Rebikoff, get his book, The Unmasked Umpire, on Amazon.
It's not called The Unmasked Umpire. It's called Unmasked, The Honorable and Dishonorable Truths of a Baseball Umpire.
The Unmasked. I apologize. I read it wrong. But The Unmasked by Zach Rebikoff. You get that on the sportscast.net under show notes. And something to take a look at. Of course, you can visit our website, thesportscast.net, or on our Twitter, thesportscast1. Zach, any closing words before we head off?
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for having me. I think I've covered most of what I think that you should have covered. If there's anything else that somebody would like to know, buy the book. There's more stories. I think in the book, you know, put some unique perspective on what it's like to be an umpire in professional baseball. We're under a lot of fire. You know, people are watching on TV, they go, how can you miss that pitch? It's not so easy sometimes. You know, it's like an usher that puts someone in the wrong seat, or you're typing on your computer and you hit the wrong key and you go back and you go, oh my God, look at that. You know, people make mistakes. So even when you're watching a game, a ball right down the middle, the umpire calls it a ball, something happened. Even the batter, sometimes on an inside pitch, the batter's knob of the bat, we block the pitch momentarily, just for a fraction of a second, you lose track of the ball before you know it's in the catcher's glove, and you miss it going across the plate. So it's not so easy. But if you got the book, you would recognize a lot of interesting things about it.
And what do you think about what they're doing now with video replay?
The best thing that ever happened. I wish we would have had it. It's the best, because Aside from arguing balls and strikes, there's no arguing. Guy slides it to second, they call him out. He just goes like this, raises his hand. They check the replay. There's no argument. Guy goes over. It's wrong. They change it. Guy hits a home run near the foul pole. No problem. Let's check. They change it. You know, back when I umpired, or even before instant replay, you know, all these illogical arguments on the field. There's no one, they're not changing it. So, you know, unless it's the only time we would change a call is if they complain that either the guy dropped the ball, his foot was off the bag, the ball bounced or went over the fence on a fly. But other than that, safe out, fair foul, there was no changing it. Ball strike, there's no changing it. Now, with the instant replay, it's not a big deal. Not a problem to change it. Go ahead. No argument. It's great.
Hey, Zach had to do it with his naked eye, but now with video replay, the game is a little bit better with the rules. But anyways, that's all we have. Get the Unmasked on Amazon. Go to thesportscast.net or go to the unmaskedumpire.com. That's Zach's website. And, hey, Zach, hopefully we'll get some more sales for you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.